facts or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss the future of Social Security with National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare Government Relations and Policy Director Dan Adcock. We'll also discuss the Affordable Care Act with Congressman John Yarmuth and the need for good-paying union jobs with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. But first, D.C. Labor Film Fest Director Chris Garlock joins us. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
This is our annual get-together. Of course, the D.C. Labor Film Fest kicks off today officially here in Washington. Tell us about the Film Fest and how we can learn more about it.
Well, it's our 12th annual, and all the details are on our website, dclabor.org. All the films, except for today's at noon, will be up at the American Film Institute in Silver Spring. It's one of our great partners on this annual festival of films about all things labor, work, workers, and the work we do.
So who is in your audience? Who are the people that attend these screenings?
Well, it's a really interesting cross-section. We've got, obviously, a lot of folks from the local labor movement, and it's kind of a fun thing because folks that I often see on the picket line or at rallies and so forth, and it's nice to see them. Something a little fun and a little different for the labor movement. And then there's folks that are just really into film. Because we are first and foremost a film festival, and so we really look for films that are good. So it's a it's a festival where you can come and you're going to see a great movie that happens to be about work and workers.
So this is your baby, I suppose, and something that you've dedicated a lot of time to. I'm curious to know how you go about picking some of the films to include into the film festival.
Well, it's pretty interesting process. There are so many great films about work, workers, labor these days. When we first started, close to 15 years ago now, honestly, the pickings were pretty slim. But one of the really great things about the last, say, decade is that the issues that we as a labor movement have been concerned about for many years have really come to the attention, not just of the independents, like the Michael Moores of the world, but of Hollywood and mainstream filmmakers. And so there, our job, it's both easier because there are more films that address our issues, and it's harder because, frankly, I have to look at, say, a short list. My short list used to be, like 10 films. And my short list now is usually 30 to 40 films that I have to narrow down to a dozen or so films. I mean, we could easily do a great film festival with two or three times as many films.
That sounds like a good problem to have.
It's a great problem. I'm not complaining. Keep making those great labor films, people. I'm not complaining.
The theme from the labor movement this year in particular, 2012, really has been the attack on public workers, and your final list of films includes a few that relate to public workers, and I want to get into some of those. The first one that caught my eye was a movie about firefighters called Burn, and I want you to tell me about the movie and why it's so applicable to the labor movement these days.
Absolutely, and it's a really good thing that you point out, and we've talked about this in previous years that, the film festival, some film festivals have a theme. Our theme, of course, is work and workers, but, have year-to-year themes. And I had actually originally thought, geez, I really would like to look for some films about public sector because, frankly, we've done over the last 2 years so many rallies about public sector issues, both nationally and locally. But it doesn't really work that way as a practical matter. But what was really cool was when we came down to our, our short list, and I looked and I was like, oh my gosh, there are actually several films here that really are about public sector workers. So the film that you're referencing is one of our best films in a series of great films, which is called Burn. And the first thing I have to tell you is that we've actually just found out that we have officially sold out our Friday night screening of Burn in the main theater at AFI, which is tremendous. We're so excited about that. But that's don't panic, folks, because AFI has just added two more screenings on Monday night and on Tuesday night. So you can check our website, dclabor.org, or the AFI's website, for details on that. So tonight's screening is sold out. It'll be full of firefighters. We're going to have an antique fire truck parked out front. It's going to be and the firefighters are doing. There's a converted firehouse on around the corner on Georgia Avenue, owned by a retired firefighter, and they're doing a happy hour before. I mean, it's a whole thing that's going. This is one of the things I love about the Labor Film Festival. It's all kinds of things jump off about that. But this is a terrific film about Detroit, which went from almost 2 million folks a generation ago down to under a million, something like 800,000 folks. And it's a film that focuses, that looks at Detroit through the eyes of the firefighters that are desperately trying to save the city, which is literally burning up before their eyes, between arson and neglect and the whole thing. And the thing that makes this film interesting, I mean, just seeing firefighters at work and their complete dedication, the kind of things that, you know, you work, you know, folks in the public sector know. And I think that's been so painful for us in the labor movement, to see the way the public sector workers are attacked. And to see firefighters and their dedication, their commitment to the community that they live in. But it's not just about Detroit, because this could be about Washington. This could be about New York. This could be about your community, anywhere you live.
These issues are critical in this time, because a lot of cities and states are facing budget shortfalls, the federal government facing budget shortfalls, and a lot of times that directly points to questions about should we reduce public services, but those reduction in public services ultimately really affect the people, and it sounds like this movie is speaking to that issue directly.
Exactly, and it's interesting, because I think that it's very easy for those in power to kind of pit, you know, folks who don't, you know, who don't work for the government, or who don't have, you know, good wages and benefits, which is a big battle that's going on right now. It's like, oh, look at these public sector workers, they're overpaid, underworked, and they forget that these are the folks that are literally, you know, keeping our lives running. And in fact, you know, so many times, you know, the work that a public sector worker does is by definition invisible. I mean, if they're doing their job well, you don't really want to see a firefighter, you know, until you need to see him, right? And so, you know, that's the kind of thing.
But when you need them, boy, you're glad they're there, right?
And you want them there, and you want them well-trained, and you want their equipment to work, right? All of that stuff needs to be happening. And I think it kind of changes people's opinions.
So are you not surprised then that this is a sellout for you guys tonight?
I'm surprised I'm not surprised. All of the films, every single film in this film. So again, you know, we really winnow it down. We've got a dozen, absolutely. And there's every one of these films you can come. You're going to have a great time. You're going to be entertained, and you're going to learn a little something about work and the work that we do. If you'd have asked me a month ago, you know, to pick which one would be a sellout, you know, this would not have been the one that I would have necessarily said, even though it was one of my personal favorites. Two other ones, the one that we're showing at noon today, free screening at the AFL-CIO, We Are Wisconsin. And, you know, your listeners know well about this struggle in Wisconsin a year and a half ago. Honestly, when I pre-screened this film, I was not expecting much. I'd been real involved in that whole, you know, struggle supporting it locally. But so many of these kind of documentaries, frankly, they're well-intentioned, but they're usually not that good. This film does, but what it does is it looks at that struggle through the eyes of six folks, you know, a social worker, a student, a teacher, a guy who works for the SWAT team. He's a cop. Right. So these are working folks, ordinary folks, and it follows them through that whole struggle. And so, first of all, it personalizes it. So it's not just rah, rah and all the stuff that happened in the Capitol that we saw, but it's a very sort of honest look, you know, day to day as this was unfolding, because it did unfold in slow motion. But the other thing that I was surprised at, especially since we have the benefit of knowing, you know, the latest on that, you know, when the recall was lost. But you come out of this film actually feeling pretty inspired, and that I was not expecting, you know, because I sort of, you know, in my mind, well, we'd had to recall and we lost it. And so that is sort of, you know, everybody says, you know, labor lost. But when you look at this film from a personal level, you realize, you know, that the specific battles over legislation, those come and go, right? You win some, you lose some, you try to win more than you lose. but that when change happens at an individual level, that does not change. And that, and so this film, and I highly recommend it, besides the fact that it's free, you can bring your lunch, is just, it come, you really become quite inspired by that struggle.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Chris Garlock, the director of the DC Labor Film Fest. Chris, on the notion of the movie We Are Wisconsin, you know, and you had mentioned that losing the recall, but do you believe that there is something to be said for being in the fight, standing up for what you believe in, regardless of what the outcome is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's always better to be in the fight. And I think that if you focus too much on the outcome or the result, in a sense, you've already lost. I mean, sometimes you win and you lose anyway, right? I mean, sometimes it seems like you lose and you win. So I think it's if you're results oriented, and I understand why that is, that, you know, it's a natural thing. And certainly in the movement, you know, you want to win. But I think that it really is the process. Being as you say, I think that's a very good way to think about it. Being in the fight, you've already won. You've already won, but just by being there, standing up, and that's one of the things you see. I will say, even it's not just in We Are Wisconsin. Every single film in the Labor Film Festival shows workers standing up. Sometimes it's a comedy, sometimes it's a musical. The Pajama Game, right? Song and dance. And yet so many of these issues, you're being entertained, you're watching singing, you're watching dancing, and then you're realizing, but wait a minute, they're singing and dancing about the same issues that we're fighting about now.
So it's not always an aggressive outward push that you would think of in terms of a fight, but different ways of expressing yourself and standing up for yourself.
Which sort of encapsulates the film fest itself. Remember that the film fest comes out, I'm the mobilizer for the Metro Washington Council. And so the reason we do the film fest, I personally love films, but the reason that I as a mobilizer do the film festival, it mobilizes people. There's going to be 400 people tonight at the screening of Burn. You know, that's mobilization, and they're going to be watching a film about workers.
And as you said, it's not just happening in the theater, in the AFI. It's also the activities going on outside with the fire trucks out there and calling attention to some of the issues that are happening these days.
And I think it's also the thing about the film fest is that I think the general public, and I think even sometimes our own members and people in the movement, are accustomed to thinking about the movement as something. It's almost like a firefighter. You know, you call your union when you got a problem, right? And we come in and we solve the problem, and then you forget about us. But as you well know, we're here 24/7 or more, you know, right?
Every single day.
Every single day, you know, whether you see us or you don't see us. And so I think the film festival is a way to sort of embody that and say that, you know, it's not just about the picket lines and the rallies, which I love, you love, you know, those are great. But it happens in a lot of other ways. We have a romantic comedy this year. You know, there should be a way of looking at work through a musical, through a romantic comedy. Last year we had a science fiction film. So I don't want work or unions to be sort of ghettoized and stuck over in this, you know, we'll call you when we need you.
There's another film here that I want to get to before we're out of time, and that is American Teachers, which I think is quite relevant, especially right now as we're going towards Election Day and there are discussions over funding of agencies like the Department of Education and where we're taking public schools in this country and just the education of our youth. Tell us about the film.
Narrated by Matt Damon, for one thing, whose mother is a teacher, and terrific film. And you know, one of the ways that the right wing has gotten very, very clever is that they are funding films, and they're funding popular mainstream films. They've got a lot of money. And there's been a number of films that have come out attacking teachers, and they win awards and they do very well. And it's honestly, it's beyond me how you know, you can attack teachers. These are the folks who teach our kids, and I've never quite understood how this gets any traction. So we're very proud to be able to contribute to this discussion and bring a film that really takes a very good look at what is happening to teachers in this country right now and the work that they do. And they're going through incredible burnout right now. This is a film. It does. Somebody said that it makes you want to call up your grade school teacher and thank them. And I think I would go with that.
That's a powerful message and something that I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you on. The formative years in their lives shaped by teachers in their middle school years, high school years, et cetera.
You and I would not be sitting here if not. And I'm sure that we could have a whole other show just on the teachers who formed people that we are today.
There is a movie here that caught my eye that it was not on my list last year for some reason. Maybe you can tell us about that. Office Space is back by popular demand.
You whined so much last year that just because of you. No, it was amazing. You know, you brought it up in the show last year, and then every screening, I don't know if people are listening to the show, but no, I think, you know, Office Space is we call it a perennial popular, and it really is. Every screening, people come up and they say, how come no Office Space this year? I say, okay, fine. No, basta, no more. So it's back. The red stapler raffle is back. So don't burn my office down. we'll have not one but two screenings. But let me just put in a plug for my new favorite this year, a great little film called Adventureland. It's destined to be a classic. It's a growing up movie. It's set in an amusement park. If you like Office Space, you're going to really like Adventureland. We're doing late shows on both of those, Friday and Saturday night, flipping them. So I'd recommend that as well.
Chris Garlock, the director of the DC Labor Film Fest. Chris, it is always a pleasure to have you in the studio talking about the Film Fest. Thanks for the great work that you do.
Pleasure's all mine. See you next year.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the future of Social Security with National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare Government Relations and Policy Director Dan Adcock.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Dan Adcock, the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jason.
Social Security is a big deal these days, especially in these contentious election times. Tell me where the program stands today.
Well, it's in really good shape. It has the Social Security Trust Fund has a surplus of $2.7 trillion. It took in more than $60 billion last year. It will continue to be able to pay 100% of benefits until 2033. And then after that time, there is a shortfall, but it would still continue to pay benefits, 75% of all benefits. But if Congress acts, can make some adjustments in the program that doesn't necessarily have to cut benefits to preserve the long-term solvency of the program, and that's something that we're going to be advocating for as an organization.
What are some of those adjustments to ensure 100% of benefits are paid?
Well, we think that benefits don't have to be cut at all. In fact, what we support is increasing the cap on Social Security payroll taxes. Normally, employees pay 6.2% of their paychecks throughout their careers towards Social Security, but they only pay that on the first $110,000 of their income. So if you're somebody like Bill Gates, you probably pay what you need to towards Social Security in the first nanosecond of the first day of the year. But, you know, if you're somebody who earns less than $110,000 a year, you're paying the full 6%. So we think it's really a question of fairness that everybody from a, you know, billionaire to a high school principal that's making $110,000 a year, you know, should be paying the same percentage into Social Security. And if we do that, we solve the program's financial problems for the long term.
What is the reaction to people that you talk to about potentially raising the cap on those income taxes?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I've only been with the National Committee for a little less than a year. When I started talking to relatives about doing that, I think there's this false assumption out there that you have to do things like increase the retirement age from until to age 69. But when I tell them that all we would really need to do is to get rid of the cap on the income tax cap on Social Security payroll taxes. The reaction is, why don't we just do that? It's a common sense solution. It's a question of fairness, and we can do it without the kind of pain. That's especially important now as things like employer-sponsored retirement plans, pensions certainly have gone by the wayside. 401k matches are less generous, and people in this economy, a lot of people can't even afford to contribute to their 401k. So Social Security is really the last pillar standing for the middle class for their retirement security, and so that's why we really need to look at solutions that really address the adequacy of Social Security, not cut benefits.
What happens if nothing is done to the program?
Well, what happens is that basically right now, according to the Social Security actuaries, in 2033, there'd be a 25% benefit cut. That's something, obviously, that we want to avoid, and we'll be working to avoid that.
What's the general consensus about the program, do you think? Do people find it valuable? Do they find it as something that's necessary? Where do you think it stands among the American people?
Well, actually, that's a good question. The National Committee has done quite a bit of polling on this, and we find across the political spectrum, across the age spectrum, that this is a government program that has overwhelming support. I mean, I'm talking, I think the last poll we did, there was over 70% of the American public, regardless of age, regardless of political affiliation. These are programs that they support, that they don't want to see used to cut the deficit, and they certainly don't want to see used as a way to pay for tax cuts to the wealthiest 2% or large corporations that move their jobs overseas.
And for our listeners out there in the audience, so that we're clear, Social Security is not something that is paying people a lot of money, getting them rich. This is just basically to sustain them basic needs, right?
That's right. In fact, the average Social Security benefit is about $14,000 a year. So nobody's getting rich off of Social Security. That's why, if you're financially able to, you really do need to save enough money, because for most people, depending on where they live in the country, $1,400 is not exactly a lot of money, not enough money really to live on. So that's why retirement savings is so important.
One of the more contentious points of Social Security is something that you referenced earlier, which is the age limit or when you can start to take it and whatnot. What do you say to people who say to you, Dan, listen, people are healthier, longer, careers are extending, why not just raise the age?
Well, that's true, but again, the increase in longevity is an average. Not everybody lives longer. And you really, I used to say that there's winners and losers to this proposal. There are no winners to this proposal. For everybody, it's a benefit cut. And the people who are disproportionately hurt by this are people who are in physically demanding jobs. Not everybody's going to be able to work to age 69. And the other part that we know is that, especially for African Americans, statistically speaking, do not live as long as their white counterparts. And so you could very well pay into this program your entire life and never see a dime out of it. And so that's something we want to avoid.
And I think you bring up a good point about the types of jobs. Obviously, a construction worker probably won't be able to do that type of manual labor up to 69, while someone maybe in a desk job who's working in an office might be able to hang in there a little longer.
They could, but even for that office worker, it's still a benefit cut. Yeah.
So where do you think that your organization is going in the next several months based around the election?
Well, one of the things we're very concerned about is is Congressman Ryan's Medicare plan that would end traditional Medicare, privatize it for the benefit of insurance companies, make it harder for seniors to choose their own doctors, and also cut prescription drug and preventive care, and also nursing home benefits. And so, regardless of the election results, we think that this proposal is something that's going to be on the table for a long time to come. We're also concerned about what happens in the lame duck session of Congress, and concerned about the Bowles-Simpson plan being used as a template for deficit reduction talks, because there's really a lot of bad proposals in there that would cut Social Security and Medicare.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Dan Adcock, the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Dan, if the American people elect Mitt Romney as president and Paul Ryan as vice president, are you genuinely fearful for the program of Medicare in its entirety?
Absolutely, because basically we believe that the Ryan Medicare plan, and we think that's probably the way they will go with it. I mean, it certainly has overwhelming support of amongst the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, because it basically it changes this program where you know that from year to year you have affordable and predictable health care to basically getting this limited payment Congressman Ryan likes to call it is premium support. I think we're going to start calling it premium neglect, because what happens is that over time the payment that would be available would not keep up with healthcare inflation, and it would mean that seniors would have to pay more to receive the same coverage, and some of them are just not going to be able to do that. I mean, it's going back again to that the average Social Security benefit is only $14,000 a year, and 50% of Medicare beneficiaries their income is less than $23,000. So you really are in a situation where, you know, if you shrink, move the risk of increases in premiums to beneficiaries, then you really are putting them in a position where they're going to have to look at the least expensive plans that were likely going to be private plans and likely have very limited networks and gatekeepers. And, you know, people are dying to get into Medicare. They want to leave the private insurance bureaucracy, and they want Medicare because they can go see any doctor they want. And that's especially important as people age.
I think you bring up a good point about this, and this is one of the fundamental differences I see between the two parties. One person said to me yesterday that when you hear the words reform, you should really think cut.
Right.
Is that something that you would agree with?
I would. It doesn't reform Social Security. Or Medicare rather. It ends traditional Medicare. You know, the other language that's being used to support it is that you get your choice of plans. Well, that choice doesn't mean anything if you're in a plan that reduces your choices of doctors.
So ultimately, what are you expecting to come out of this, the Democratic National Convention, the rest of the time that you're here?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the convention serves as a way to do some truth telling about some of the proposals that Congressman Ryan and Government Romney about some of the things that they want that they want to do to Medicare and Social Security, because you know this is a very important election. People need to be educated about what their choices are, and that's something that the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare we've just launched an educational campaign to do just that, to make sure people make educated decisions about who they vote for in this election.
One last thing before we let you go, Dan, and that is, while we've spent a lot of time here talking about the ins and outs of Social Security and Medicare, what about the workers? What about the Social Security Administration employees,
right,
who are underfunded, understaffed, they're facing office closures that impacts the general public? What do you think about some of these things?
Well, and you know, as we talked earlier, we used to be with the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, and you know, and federal employees and retirees just generally are under threat, and specifically I think that's also true of the Social Security Administration. They're also going to be affected by the sequester, the across-the-board cut in government spending that's going to be required in January. So they're dealing with that. They're underfunded. You know, we as an organization have been fighting to make sure that they have the money they need. You know, one of the things we're really concerned as we move forward is that they're just not going to have the personnel necessary to process the disability claims that they're looking at. Congressman Chuck Grassley from Iowa once said that it takes longer to train the people at the Social Security Administration who process those disability claims than it takes to train a NASA astronaut. So, you know, if you don't have the money to kind of keep that staff, and you haven't brought the people in the pipeline that takes to train, then you're asking for real trouble.
Dan Adcock, the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Dan, pleasure to see you here today. Have a great week.
Thanks, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the Affordable Care Act with Congressman John Yarmuth.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman John Yarmuth, representing the 3rd District in Kentucky. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So the last time that we talked to you, we chatted a lot about health care reform and the state of health care in this country. We sit here today at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. What has changed with the Affordable Care Act, if anything, since the last time we talked?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of us who supported the Affordable Care Act have been out talking about it, have been reminding our constituents about the benefits of it, and quite frankly, our constituents are learning more about it. And for instance, I say, you know, every Saturday in Louisville, there is a walk or something for juvenile diabetes or cancer or heart disease, and 1,000 or 2,000 people show up. Every one of those people represents a family or families who are benefited by the Affordable Care Act, and they know it. So now when you talk about repealing the protections, lifetime caps, one of the speakers at the convention last night talked about that. People say, no, not so much. There's some good things in here.
Do you see that as buy-in, getting the buy-in to acceptance on the Affordable Care Act is just educating people and continuing to talk about it?
This has been the problem since day one. When I had the opportunity back in 2009 and 10 when we were talking about passing it, when I had a half hour to sit and explain the benefits and answer people's questions about how it affected them, they almost always became fans of the legislation. Healthcare is like no other issue we deal with in that the impact is different for every person. And it's hard to market a piece of legislation to 300 million people individually. It's not like energy where you can say, well, your utility bills are going to go up or down a certain percent. The impact's relatively uniform, not with healthcare.
There are varying levels with which people depend upon healthcare in this country, some not so much and some very greatly.
Very greatly. And if you're a 58-year-old who just lost his or her job and your COBRA's about to run out, you're in a different spot than a 22-year-old who just got out of college and was dropped from parents' policies and had a juvenile diabetes or something like that. So, everybody wanted to know how it affected them and their family.
And I think one of the key things here in this issue is while many things in life are within our control, healthcare and your health is not. It is you are what you are.
That's why I've always argued with those people who said, oh, we need a free market approach to healthcare. You can't have a free market if the demand side is not under control. It's not an equal the buyer and seller proposition. You need health care when you need it, and you don't know when that's going to come.
That's a very interesting idea about the demand side of it and not being able to control that. What's the response that you get when you bring that up to people?
People's eyes sort of open a little bit, and they say, well, I hadn't thought about that. The free market has never worked in healthcare in this country. I mean, people forget. This is kind of one of those, oh, you're better off 4 years now than you were 4 years ago. People don't remember that 4 years ago, insurance premiums were rising at a rate of sometimes 35-40% a year. As a matter of fact, during the healthcare debate, California, they raised all the rates got raised 38%. Now, we were in a crisis situation with the private insurance market then. We still haven't gotten out of that. We're still having a problem with the private market. Hopefully, in 2014, when the private market reforms go into place, that'll change. And I think it's already started to change a little bit. But, we had a crisis, and we still have employers who are saying, I had to raise my deductible to $5,000 for my employees, or I had to add these copays, or so forth, because the cost of private insurance is getting so uncontrollable. And I think the Affordable Care Act's going to solve some of those problems, but it's again, we were in pretty much of a critical situation 4 years ago, before we actually took these steps.
And you bring up a great point. That question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, seems to be a central part of this election season. And I'll ask you, your constituents in Kentucky, when you talk to them, do they tell you they're better off than they were 4 years ago?
Well, I think there's still so many Americans, and my constituents as well, who are not better off. Individually, there are far too many people who are not better off. The country as a whole is far better off. My community is far better off than it was four years ago. I mean, we had a Ford plant that was on the brink of being eliminated, and at the end of this year, we will have 3,100 more employees at that plant than we had a year ago. We will now have the most advanced, the largest Ford facility in North America, and that's, again, over the last 4 years. GE, one of our largest employers, GE's Appliance Park, was actually being there was a negotiation to sell the division to the Chinese. Now, 4 years later, they've invested $1 billion more in that plant. They brought three new lines of product there, including 430 jobs from China back to the United States in my district. So we have these very high profile improvements in the economic landscape in my district. So people don't really ask that question because they know things are better. Even though it may not be better for them individually.
Job creation certainly is going to be the key focus in this election. Let me ask you about job creation on a small business front. What are your thoughts on that as a driver for the economy? Do you see the small business community as a part of the economy that must get going in order for everything else to happen?
Of course. You know, once you reach a certain size, the only way you actually, in most cases, improve your profitability is to create efficiencies. And that's why the opportunities for significant growth are much lower or much less in a big company as there are in a small company. Perfect example, and this was a company, and I can't remember the name of it, but there's a company in Denver that actually got some money from the energy program, the same one that the cylinder came out of, that funding. They started off with about 50 employees. They developed a product that is revolutionary. All of a sudden, they got an injection of private capital. They had 200 employees. Then GE came along and bought them, and they're going to have, in a very short period of time, 2,000 employees. That's a small business that went from 50 to 2,000 in just a very short period of time. So that's where the true growth opportunities are. But the bottom line is most small businesses rely on demand, and the fundamental problem we have in the economy still is that we haven't increased the buying power of the vast majority of Americans, and we have to do that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman John Yarmuth, representing the 3rd District in Kentucky. Congressman, I've spoken to a number of people who represent younger voters this week, people from organizations that focus on the younger crowd. One of the topics that came up was the types of jobs that young people are looking for. Do you think as a country we are encouraging young people to pursue the kinds of jobs that will give them careers to last a lifetime?
I think we are not doing a good enough job of doing that. And one of the things that many of us have been focused on in Congress is that, for instance, if we as a country want to promote science and technology and engineering and math professions, we have to make sure that when they get those degrees, that there's an opportunity for them. So when you have people, and unfortunately on the other side of the aisle, who want to cut back on research and scientific, you're saying, well, where's the opportunity for me? So we're sending a mixed message with our policy, and I think that's why the president is absolutely on target when he says we have to increase our investments in research and development, because if we don't, again, why would anybody go into those fields? And we risk losing so much ground to the rest of the world until we do that. So I guess the bottom line answer, we're not doing nearly enough in that area to create the kind of future prospects for our young people as we should be.
Do you think if we were able to invest more in infrastructure, that more opportunities in some of those fields would become available in engineering and science and math to be able to create those projects to make the country better?
Absolutely right. I mean, we just broke ground on a major bridges project in Louisville. And one of the things we talked about was not just the construction jobs that would come about, but also the engineering jobs and the architecture jobs and the jobs that require a higher level of education. It's absolutely true, and we've got huge infrastructure needs in this country. As virtually everyone knows, that's a bipartisan consensus. We all know we have to do that. We want to do it now, and the Republicans don't. But, again, across the board, investing in our infrastructure will create jobs throughout the across the spectrum of employment opportunities.
Now that we have solved the nation's problems in this interview, I want to ask you a fun question. Right. Of course, we're here at the Democratic National Convention. What's your favorite part about being at this event?
Well, I do get inspired at Democratic conventions because of the diversity I see. And it's the same feeling I get, and I don't really want to get highly partisan, but when I'm on the floor of the House and I look at our side of the aisle and then I look at their side of the aisle, and I know that I am part of what America really is. This is the fabric. And when you see this convention, clearly the different types of people that it brings together, it's truly just a very clear visual of what this country is all about. And so that excites me most. I mean, obviously there are lots of I see a lot of friends that I've made over the years from across the country, and that's always an enjoyment too. But it's mostly, again, just getting a deeper understanding of what the Democratic Party is all about and what this country is all about.
Do you think that the message is being heard loud and clear across the country this week?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell. I saw where the ratings for Governor Romney's speech were down 30% from last year. It'll be interesting to see what the ratings for Michelle Obama's speech last night were, and then tonight, and of course the president's tomorrow night. I hope so, and because I think that if there's anything that can more inspire Americans about the value of our system and the beauty of our democracy and our government, it's this type of activity. And I'll say that about the Republican convention as well. I mean, that's what this is about. This is about what makes our country unique.
Congressman John Yarmuth from Kentucky, you are one of our favorites here. Thank you so much for coming by and seeing us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Take care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll address the need for good-paying union jobs with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by one of our favorites, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, representing the 9th District in Illinois. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
I'm so happy to be with you, Jason. Thank you.
We are at an exciting time here at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. What have you seen and done so far?
Well, first of all, Charlotte's a party. And I've been telling all the volunteers and even the police and other, you know, law enforcement people, everyone is so nice, accommodating, helpful, positive. The environment is just wonderful. I was in Tampa, and no offense to Tampa, but I didn't see outside celebrating going on like I see here. It's just been very exciting. And then, of course, inside the convention hall, fabulous.
Speaking of celebrating, right? Yeah, there was just a tremendous set of speeches last night on the first night. What stood out to you most?
Well, I think Michelle Obama had to be the one. You know, leaving the convention hall reminded me of 2004 when Barack Obama gave his speech and everyone was talking president. Last night people were saying, and, you know, I don't know how, I don't think it's real, but from her point of view, people saying, what about Michelle Obama in 2016? She was remarkable, I thought. Her ability, the authenticity, that's actually, I think, the word for all of the people who spoke, each one of them bringing their story in such a real way. Mayor Castro, and there was his mom and his little girl who could resist. But he has an important story. Michelle talking about herself and Barack and how they grew up, I think just resonated with so many Americans. Every American, I think, could nod their head at some speech. Tammy Duckworth from my state, a veteran and her experience, or the mom whose child almost hit her lifetime cap as a baby because she needed the heart surgery, and all of these real life experiences that were told. Lily Ledbetter, what a star she was last night. You know, Deval Patrick was absolutely amazing, one after another. And people were on their feet, not because they were raging against anything. They were cheering for, and I think that's a big difference between our convention and the Republican convention, too.
There certainly was a lot of enthusiasm inside the arena last night, and in particular, First Lady Obama's speech. She gave a very personal look at the president, a very passionate look at the president.
You know, that, yes, but it was also tied inextricably to a set of values. And I think that that's really what comes through, I think, for people, that we do have those shared values of family, of people being able to make it, the fact that they were able to get those college loans, which they fairly recently paid off. But, you know, the value piece, the progressive values that are part of their life, that drive their life, family, and, you know, in their jobs, as his job as president, I think was just woven together so beautifully.
You come from the same state as President Obama.
It's in the water, you know, in Illinois.
Do you have a story or two that you could share about your time working with the president, something that maybe the American people just don't know about him?
Here's just one little story about his demeanor and how he conducts himself. I was with him in one of the last days of the Senate race in Illinois. I think it was the primary race in Illinois, which was competitive for him. And I was campaigning too. I was in his van, and there were like three cell phones, and things were ringing, and something didn't go well back at the office. And so some kind of crisis always is in a campaign. And what I really was impressed with was how calm and steady and always respectful to the staff, telling people not to worry, being a real leader. Okay, you know, it'll be fine. You do this and you do this. And I'm thinking, this guy really is on top of his emotions. He's very calm and cool and results oriented. Just a little insight into how he handles problems.
Do you think that is something that is clearly important and resonates well with the American people in terms of leadership?
I really do, because I think they want somebody who isn't going to be reactive that wants to be responsible as they think through. Some people say, why didn't he do this faster? And at the end of the day, people say, yeah, he was right to think about it for a couple days, to watch what's going to happen. Barack doesn't have huge highs and lows. He says that about himself. Very steady. That's what you want in a president.
Very even keel in making those decisions. One of the central issues, if not the central issue, in this election season is the economy and job creation. What are your thoughts on where we stand today?
Look, with everyday sabotage by the Republicans, who are interested in only one job, and that's President of the United States, they absolutely halted the kind of progress we could have made and still 4.5 million jobs created. If you look at the net private sector jobs in the Bush administration, zero. Zero at the end of the day. And so the fact that we have been able on every parameter to at least move forward, is it where we want to go? Is it where the president wants to go? No. But despite the fact of the obstruction of the Republicans, we've made incredible progress.
What kinds of jobs do you think we should be creating in this country to give people not just a job for today, but a career for tomorrow?
Well, first of all, let's stress in this country, it used to be that people could have a good union job, and that I want to underline union, because I believe in the dignity of work. So you can work in an auto plant, you can work in a steel mill, and it's a job that's going to provide you the ability to have a middle class life. So I think the common thread, frankly, for what kind of a job could be a career, could be worth spending your life, I want to put union first.
And on top of that, how about something in the way of public service, federal service, dedicating your life to something that's greater than just yourself, much in the way that you have as a member of Congress. You're a federal servant as well.
You know, and I make a good living. But unfortunately, sometimes people have to make choices. For example, not to go to do Teach for America because you have such college debt that you can't afford a job in public service because it's not going to let you live because you have so much to pay in college debt these days. So, yes, absolutely. We want to be able to encourage people to go into public service, but not to have to make the choice, am I going to be able to, you know, have a family, start a family, have a family, maybe someday own a home. We want to make sure that those jobs pay as well.
Sure, and I think a good example of maybe what you're talking about is someone like a nurse in the VA who might be making $30,000, $40,000 a year. That nurse knows that he or she will not be making millions of dollars, but is going into a career that he or she believes is just the right thing to do.
You know, and if there's some job security and some health care and some retirement security that goes with it, then it's worth it, because I don't think people are necessarily looking to buy another yacht or a mansion, but they want to be able to have a life that's good for them and for their children. And this demonization of public sector workers, I don't even know where that comes from, really. I don't, because those are the people of the glue of our community, the visible jobs in our community, the teachers, the police, the firefighters, when you go to get your driver's license, when you go to City Hall. Those are the people who make our country run, our cities and communities run. And I'm really kind of mystified how all of a sudden public sector workers have become bad people.
Lastly, Congresswoman, before we let you go here, what are you most hoping to see the rest of the week here in Charlotte at the convention?
Well, I hope that we're going to be able to get through the accomplishments of the Obama administration and the things that we're going to be able to do with another 4 years, especially if we can get a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate and actually move an agenda forward. But regardless, I think the American people are tired of, fed up with gridlock, and if we re-elect Barack Obama, I think we're going to make people's lives better and better in the next 4 years.
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, representing the 9th District in Illinois. Congresswoman, always fun to have you on
it's
our program.
Great to be here, Jason. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you to our guest this week, D.C. Labor Film Fest director Chris Garlock, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare Government Relations and Policy Director Dan Adcock, and Representatives John Yarmuth and Jan Schakowsky. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees. Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.